From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the diplomatic crisis over the treatment of an Indian envoy deepens as the US Embassy in Delhi is stripped of its security barricades.
The idea that their diplomat was strip searched or cavity searched even over filing false paperwork is pretty outrageous in any culture.
The Arctic Greenpeace activists who could leave Russia in time for Christmas after President Putin backs amnesty law. And the US lawmakers continue to protest the deal struck between Republicans and Democrats to cut the retirement pensions of military veterans and federal workers.
Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan, a $34 million new camp, sits abandoned today, never occupied. Is there any accountability in the Pentagon?
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has announced it will be reducing its economic stimulus program. It plans to cut back on its monthly asset purchases in January. Nick Harper reports from New York.
At the end of a two-day policy meeting, the U.S. Federal Reserve announced that it would be cutting back on its stimulus program, the $85 billion a month of bonds that the U.S. government buys to prop up the economy. As of January, that will be reduced by $10 billion to $75 billion, the Fed saying that the U.S. jobs market is now strong enough for tapering to begin. The markets on Wall Street jumped at the news, the Dow rising by about 100 points. There'd been much speculation about when the reduction of the stimulus program would begin, with some analysts saying it might not happen until March. However, a run of strong economic data over the last week clearly prompted the Fed to start reducing the stimulus now.
The U.S. State Department has insisted that appropriate procedures were followed during the arrest of Devani Kopragati, a senior Indian diplomat who was arrested last week in New York. It's been alleged that she was handcuffed, strip-searched, and kept in a cell with drug addicts. Ms. Kopragati, who's now released on bail, is accused of submitting false documents to obtain a work visa for her female housekeeper. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
The U.S. State Department says it understands that this is a sensitive issue for many in India and that it's looking into the procedures that were followed. But it called the incident a limited episode that should not be the cause, it said, of a diplomatic tit-for-tat with Delhi. It may be too late for that, though. Members of the Indian Parliament have already spoken out against the alleged ill-treatment, saying it was a violation of the Vienna Convention. Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has described Ms. Kopragade's treatment as deplorable. On Tuesday, security barriers around the US Embassy in Delhi were removed, and Indian MPs refused to meet with a visiting delegation of American officials. The State Department insists that Ms. Kopragade enjoys only consular immunity, which, unlike diplomatic immunity, protects her only from crimes committed in the course of her consular duties.
And the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called the ongoing violence in South Sudan a political crisis that needs an urgent solution. It follows an attempted coup and several days of fighting, in which hundreds of people are said to have died. Ban Ki-moon said he was deeply concerned about the situation.
This is a political crisis and urgently needs to be dealt with through political dialogue. There is a risk of this violence spreading to other states. It is essential to protect human rights of all those who are detained. Mandated human rights monitors must have full access to visit the detainees.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russian lawmakers unanimously passed an amnesty bill, which could see members of the Pussy Riot punk band, as well as arrested Greenpeace activists, released before the end of the year. The amnesty, marking the 20th anniversary of Russia's constitution, will be applied to thousands of Russian prisoners. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
The bill passed by the Russian State Duma had initially stated that amnesty could only be granted to convicted prisoners, but the lawmakers have decided to extend it to individuals facing trial. This means that 30 people charged with hooliganism after a Greenpeace protest in the Arctic in September could be free from prosecution. Pussy Riot punk band members serving two-year jail terms for their performance at a Moscow cathedral also qualify to be released under the amnesty, according to the Russian media reports. The amnesty will not affect former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is serving his second eight-year sentence. A suspended five-year sentence on embezzlement charges for opposition leader Alexei Navalny will not be changed under the new bill.
And the pace of U.S. home construction jumped 22.7% in the month of November, reaching its highest levels since February of 2008. The report issued by the Commerce Department indicates that the housing market is continuing its recovery despite rising mortgage rates. From New York, Iris Spitzer reports.
U.S. home starts figures exceeded most expectations and is another positive signal for the U.S. housing market. Builders are also benefiting from a low inventory of available homes, which is sending prices higher. One potential impediment to the housing recovery is higher mortgage rates, which, while still low by historical standards, have been steadily rising. However, unemployment levels are also at their lowest since 2008, which will continue to help the housing market if that trend continues. Permits for future projects were also near a five-year high, a positive indication for the continued growth of the market in 2014.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A diplomatic row is deepening following the arrest and alleged treatment of an Indian envoy in New York. In reaction, Indian officials have removed security barriers outside the US Embassy in New Delhi. India's consular official, Devyani Kobragade, was arrested last week and charged over submitting false documents in relation to her female housekeeper. I discussed the latest developments with our New York correspondent, Nick Harper.
The State Department have spoken about this issue for the last couple of days, and quite simply they've said that it's a sensitive issue and that they're going to look very carefully at the arrest procedure for Ms. Kobragade. And they throughout have tried to reinforce the very close ties that the US and India have enjoyed for many years, but it's something that they seem to be taking more seriously after, first of all, seeming to hope that it would be an issue that would go away quite quickly. They're now having to about turn on that and take it a bit more seriously than they first seemed to.
Can you remind us of the case surrounding Ms. Kobragade's arrest and subsequent treatment, and why this has caused such a furore in India especially?
Well, Ms. Kobragade was arrested and charged with two things: visa fraud and making false statements. She's accused of bringing a servant from India into the US to work with her in New York. Now, that itself was absolutely fine, but how she went about that is the problem. She said that she was going to pay this servant nearly $10 an hour, but the servant is claiming that she was in fact paid only $3.31 an hour. And as a result, that creates a problem with the visa that she had filed, because the servant had to be paid a certain minimum wage to be allowed into the country. Now, the problem is that Ms. Kobragade was arrested. It said that she was arrested when she was dropping her daughter off at school, and it's then said that she was strip searched. Now, those two things, the fact that she was arrested and handcuffed and then strip searched, have caused big problems in India. They feel that people should be treated in a certain way, especially Indian women, and they've said that her treatment was barbaric. They've said that they're shocked and appalled by her treatment, and quite simply they feel that the US government has humiliated her. Now, there is a differing opinion. We've heard from the Marshals Service, who are in charge of making arrests, and they have said, or at least someone has said off the record, who didn't want to be named, that she was only handcuffed when she arrived at the courthouse. And they say that that is a courtesy that's not normally afforded to most people, that she wasn't handcuffed at the school itself. And they're saying that her intake and detention procedures were along policy guidelines. Everything that they did, they say, are on along those policy guidelines. But it's caused huge problems in India. The Indian government and Indian media very unhappy about how Ms. Kobragade has been treated.
So unhappy that they've actually taken some action concerning the US embassy in India, is that right?
That's right, yes. On Tuesday, we saw them removing security barriers from outside the US embassy in New Delhi. On top of that, they snubbed an official visit by some US officials to the country. They've called the US ambassador to India to come and see them. And they're trying to take this to the highest level, calling on the US government to do exactly all they can. The State Department, however, says that at this stage, Muzgor-Brigadi only has consular immunity, and therefore she can still be arrested for those crimes she is alleged to have carried out. However, Muzgor-Brigadi instead wants to try and claim diplomatic immunity, which would mean that she couldn't be prosecuted under US law. The difference is that with diplomatic immunity, she would be immune from any crimes. Under consular immunity, she would only be immune from crimes in connection to her diplomatic work. That's something that she wants to try and claim and therefore try and get out of the charges against her.
FSN's Nick Harper in New York. To discuss what impact this incident could have on Washington-New Delhi relations, I spoke to Persis Kambhata, an expert on US-India policy studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
Bit of a misreading of the situation from the point of view of the United States. Indian culture is more traditional and conservative than in the United States, but the idea that their diplomat was strip-searched or cavity-searched even over filing false paperwork is pretty outrageous in any culture. I'm guessing that this story probably caught fire quickly in India because of cultural sensitivities. As well, India is about to go into the polls in a few months for their national election. And this kind of an incident can easily be used by candidates from the different parties to grandstand or make themselves more nationalistic than the other. And it is a big story for them. It's an unfortunate big story.
How damaging do you think this case could prove for India-US relations? We've already seen the US embassy stripped of its security barricades in India. The embassy representative had been summoned by the Indian authorities out there. Could this spiral further?
Hopefully it won't spiral further. Hopefully it's going to be handled by the two sides at the highest level of authority very quickly. It appears that the diplomat in question has been transferred to the UN mission now, which means that they are looking to find a resolution to the issue. It clearly has the attention at high levels of both governments. I don't know about how high or if it's at the highest appropriate level, but hopefully it doesn't spiral any further than it already has.
Can you explain the current state of relations between the two countries and what's at stake if this row continues to escalate?
Right. Well, that's a good question. U.S.-India relations have warmed considerably over the past 20 years, and the relationship strong at all levels, from government to government, business to business, and people to people. The Indian-American community here is over 3 million people strong now. We host thousands of Indian students at our universities every year, and trade and political links are very robust. We have over 30 official bilateral dialogues that occur throughout the year. Two-way trade stands at about $100 billion, and it continues to grow. India's economy is growing, and it'll probably be the world's third largest economy, in the not-too-distant future. So given all of this, the incident is humiliating on a personal level for the diplomat and for both of our governments. It should be handled in a quiet manner, not in quite the public way that it is being handled, and it should be handled at the highest levels because this is a very unfortunate, humiliating way to treat, anybody's diplomat, but also a young woman from another country, whether she's a diplomat or not.
Persis Kambhata. As the US Senate scrambles to pass both the federal budget and the National Defense Authorization Act before leaving Washington for vacation, some lawmakers continue to protest the deal struck between Republicans and Democrats to cut the retirement pensions of military veterans and federal workers. Both members of Congress and nonpartisan watchdog groups have identified several areas of wasteful government spending that they say should be cut instead. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has more.
This week, lawmakers have been lamenting the country's tight fiscal situation, which only some believe will be helped by the 2014-2015 budget deal expected to pass on Wednesday. In passionate speeches on the Senate floor, Congress members asserted that we're broke as a nation and have, quote, very little money to spare. But some of their colleagues disagreed, arguing there's plenty of money to go around, it just isn't being spent on the right priorities.
the Defense Department and people in the other non-defense discretionary departments screaming about the cupboard is bare, there's nothing else to cut. And the fact is that just isn't true.
That's Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn, who this week released a report outlining more than $30 billion of waste he says could be eliminated from all branches and sectors of government, including Congress itself. He says many copies of thousands of bills are printed on paper at a cost of $126 million a year, when the legislation is accessible for free online. He also notes that Congress members can receive up to $1,000 of taxpayer money per month to lease cars, and retired speakers of the House can spend up to $1 million a year to maintain an office. His report also identified up to $1.8 billion per month spent paying intelligence contractors to sit idle while they wait for their security clearances to be processed. And he also supports revoking the nonprofit status of the NFL and several other lucrative sports leagues, which he said could bring in hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. But the biggest savings, he said, can be found in the Pentagon's $600 billion plus annual budget, which he said is filled with silliness and poor judgment.
The Pentagon ordered, at the insistence of us, by the way, some airplanes for Afghanistan. Guess what we've done? We've sent them straight to the Arizona desert. Just $422 million worth of them. And oh, by the way, the ones that we did go to Afghanistan, we're going to cut up, destroy. We're not going to send them to Africa for relief missions. We're not going to send them somewhere else. We're going to cut them into pieces. Another $200 million worth of airplane. And oh, by the way, Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan. A $34 million new camp for troops sits abandoned today. Never occupied. Is there any accountability in the Pentagon?
Coburn wrote a letter to the Defense Department outlining these and other concerns. Their budget advisor, Robert Hale, wrote back, saying that many of their efforts to cut spending have been thwarted by Congress. He listed several expensive, low-priority weapons programs they want to eliminate, but which Congress has voted to continue. And he also accused Congress of rejecting their efforts to consolidate infrastructure. Ethan Rosencrans, with a project on government oversight, explained that as the armed forces shrink during the drawdown of two massive wars, the Pentagon has asked Congress's permission to continue closing some of its hundreds of bases in the U.S., which it estimates will save billions of dollars over time. But under the bill expected to pass this week, they'd be barred from doing so.
Congress has prohibited the department from even considering doing another Brock round, let alone carrying it out. Now, the department has said for a number of years that it has roughly 20% excess infrastructure domestically, that 20% of its bases are being unused and obviously costing money because they're being unused.
Groups ranging from the Congressional Progressive Caucus to the conservative Cato Institute have also released reports this year identifying other ways to save, from cutting $2 billion spent each year on military marching bands and other music groups to saving $110 billion by curtailing the use of private contractors to do projects that could be done by government workers. They say these and other spending cuts would make the current proposal to cut the pensions of military retirees and disabled veterans unnecessary. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports.
The Duma, the Russian parliament, have finalized the conditions of the amnesty, which will include the circumstances around our prosecution. So there's a lot of I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, which, to be honest, we have no idea how long that may yet take.
David Houseman, one of the Greenpeace activists held in Russia, speaking to Radio New Zealand today on the possibility of his release. An amnesty backed by Russian President Vladimir Putin could see the imminent release of the Arctic Greenpeace activists, along with two members of the punk band Pussy Riot. The move has been viewed as an attempt by Moscow to improve its international reputation ahead of next year's Sochi Winter Games. The amnesty follows the announcement that a US delegation, including openly gay athletes, will attend the Winter Games in what's being viewed as a snub to Russia's anti-gay legislation. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Michael Newcity, a lawyer and scholar of Russia's legal system.
There's a long tradition in Russia that predates the current post-communist system. It actually predates the communist system as well, of granting amnesty to various categories of prisoners to commemorate certain important public holidays or events. This particular amnesty that was adopted is to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the adoption of the Russian Constitution. And it, like all of these amnesties, applies not to individuals but to categories of prisoners and defendants. And it applies to women, men over the age of 55, juveniles, mothers with children, and several other categories. And it's limited in terms of the gravity of the offenses. It applies to individuals who have been sentenced to incarceration for 5 years or less. But one provision that is also included in the amnesty is that it applies to three specific provisions of the criminal code of the Russian Federation. It applies to the provisions that make it a crime to engage in mass rioting, also hooliganism, and then also certain violations of driving regulations. And what the amnesty says is that individuals who have been imprisoned as a result of violations of these provisions are eligible for the amnesty as well. Now, the hooliganism provision in particular is very important because that is one of the most common criminal offenses in the Russian legal system. It essentially is equivalent to a charge of disorderly conduct. And these are the provisions, or this is the provision under which the two women from the Pussy Riot band were convicted. And also, it is the offense that the Greenpeace activists have been charged with. They, of course, have not yet been tried or convicted. The inclusion of hooliganism as one of the offenses covered by the amnesty was very significant for those two groups.
The timing of this amnesty is key as well, isn't it? Because we are just months away from the 2014 Winter Olympics, which are being held in the Russian city of Sochi. And the reason why this is important is because at the same time you have the US announcing a delegation to the Winter Games, which includes some high-profile gay members. And this is obviously all in light of the what's been called the gay propaganda law that was introduced in Russia.
The delegation that has just been announced to go to Sochi doesn't include any currently active member of the cabinet. The head of the delegation is a former cabinet member, Janet Napolitano. And then, as you say, it was obviously they've included two openly gay former athletes as members of the delegation as well. And all of these actions by the Germans, French, and the United States are directed at the legislation that was adopted last summer that made it a criminal offense to propagandize on behalf of what the law kind of coyly refers to as untraditional sexual lifestyles. And there's been a lot of discussion and criticism of Russia for its human rights record generally, but certainly its treatment of homosexuals as well. And it's hard not to believe that the Russian amnesty that they've just granted, that they've just adopted, is an attempt on the part of the Russians to repair their image with respect to human rights.
Russian legal expert Professor Michael Newcity. Now, European Union officials have been increasingly confident about the Eurozone's economic recovery for several months now, but recently disappointing figures on the health of the French and Italian economies have painted a different picture. On the eve of a summit of EU leaders gathering for talks in Brussels on Thursday, our European correspondent Sandra Gatman has an update.
It's holiday season in much of Europe, but the Eurozone is lacking real cheer, according to mixed figures from the single currency bloc, which reveal economic recovery is still somewhat frosty. The 17-member monetary union took until the second quarter of this year to emerge from a long recession, which officials in Brussels were quick to celebrate as the start of an end to the three-year crisis. In November, manufacturing picked up slightly, but subsequent data saw the bloc's overall industrial output drop between September to October. It's of particular concern to countries like Ireland, which has just left an EU bailout program. Jolt Darvas is an economist at the think tank Bruegel.
Ireland, it is mostly the pharmaceutical industry, which accounts for about 10% of GDP. So it is the pharmaceutical sector that drives GDP growth, while all other sectors of the economy are not really growing.
Greece, Cyprus and Portugal will remain on an EU lifeline for now, subsidized largely by a still thriving German economy. Meanwhile, the euro area's second and third largest economies, France and Italy, are struggling to stimulate growth after emerging from recession, exacerbated by their efforts to reduce their large deficits in order to reach agreed EU targets. With unemployment rates already above 20% in the entire eurozone, the necessary spending cuts are proving a very tough sell politically. Speaking to shoppers at the Christmas market in the Belgian capital of Brussels, it was evident that not many here share the view that Europe is out of the thick of it just yet.
The people don't like to spend much money when they're going to drink something at a cafe or to go to eat at a restaurant. They are very careful.
I think we're still in the middle of the crisis, and I think in a couple of months we will see more unemployment, because in the news they talk all the time about that the companies are restructuring.
There's hope that an eventual banking union will put an end to taxpayer-funded bank bailouts. EU countries have already agreed on the setup of a single supervisor to monitor the health of European banks. But they're at huge odds over the design of a single resolution authority and its access to a proposed 60 billion euro fund to dissolve bad banks. Germany is particularly unhappy with the idea that its taxpayers would bear the brunt of those costs. Nikos Christopoulos is a member of the Crisis Observatory, who says the banking union needs to be a priority if Europe wants market confidence to return.
The legislative completion of the banking union is the only way to restore the integrity of the single market in the eurozone, which is falling apart.
For now, though, the eurozone is far from the edge of financial collapse. Greece and Cyprus remain in the club, as does Slovenia, despite earlier fears that its weak banks would need EU aid. The single currency is even welcoming Latvia as a new member on January 1st. All signs of stability in the eurozone, which could be considered a good thing if it weren't for the painfully slow pace of economic growth that lies ahead. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can always contact us via email at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And we're on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producers Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.